Arise, the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here this morning on case 13-821, our first case, State of Ohio versus Damon Bevely. For the appellant, Mr. Adams.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court and Mr. Taylor, I'm David Strait here on behalf of Damon Bevely this morning, the defendant appellant in this case. With the court's leave, I'd like to request 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case is an appeal from convictions for gross sexual imposition in violation of Revised Code Section 2907.05. And a particular issue is the constitutionality of the mandatory sentencing provisions of that statute, particularly in light of the recent United States Supreme Court opinion in Allain versus United States. The statutory provision in question designates the offense in question as a third-degree felony, but goes on to say that when evidence other than the testimony of the victim was admitted in the case to corroborate the victim, the court shall impose a mandatory prison term. And it's our view that that runs afoul of what the United States Supreme Court ruled in Allain. In Allain, the court determined in an extension of Sixth Amendment jurisprudence going as far back as Apprendi that any fact that increases the minimum penalty, the sentencing floor, must be charged in the indictment, submitted to the jury, and proven by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. By converting this third-degree felony into a mandatory sentencing term, the legislature has effectively changed the floor. Now, third-degree felonies, the trial court has broad discretion in fashioning an appropriate sentence, including non-prison terms, community control, both residential and non-residential community control.
The fact that is determined here about the corroborating evidence doesn't bump it up to a different felony level. It just enhances the penalty, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So this is not an Oregon versus ICE situation, the way the U.S. Supreme Court has taken a look at the ability of a judge to impose consecutive sentences. This is not a sentencing decision, you're saying, but more in the line of Apprendi?
I believe it is more in the line of Apprendi, particularly in light of Allain, Your Honor. I think the court was quite clear in the majority that it was an Apprendi-type issue, an extension of Apprendi. In Apprendi, the court held that a factor that increased the maximum had to be determined by jury, not by the judge. This says facts that increase the minimum.
So not just the ceiling, but the floor is a matter for the jury to decide.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. That is the holding of Allain.
And you say it also must be included in the indictment.
I believe it is, Your
Honor. As an element?
Yes. Justice Thomas's opinion in a couple of points indicates that as well. And that's an extension of what he'd written before in other cases, that an element such as this must both be alleged in the indictment as well as proven in court and determined by the jury.
Does the fact that it was played, this corroboration was part of a sentencing hearing, not the case in chief, make any difference here?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor, because in our record, this case arises from guilty pleas. During the plea hearing itself, the trial judge was quite clear that this issue regarding the legality or constitutionality of the mandatory sentencing provision would be determined before the court moved on to sentence.
So the defendant had noticed that the enhancement was coming.
He was aware that that was a possibility, but that was not by virtue of the indictment itself. That was by virtue of what went on in court.
What went on in court, and was there an objection registered to having this corroboration put on the record?
There was no objection, but the context of the case, Your Honor, is that at the time of the plea hearing, the parties knew they were going to litigate this. The court advised Mr. Bevely of his trial rights and the possible consequences, but indicated that this issue regarding the mandatory nature of the sentence, or rather the constitutionality of it, would be determined subsequent to the plea hearing. And then after that plea hearing, the parties briefed the issue. The court generated a decision finding it to be unconstitutional. Then the plea took place. So while there was no objection per se, his position was articulated both in court and in the post-hearing briefing.
Well, counsel, are you suggesting that there is a way to do it constitutionally?
Yes, there are a couple of ways to do it constitutionally, Your Honor, one of which is the way that the trial judge did, which was essentially to excise this mandatory provision by virtue of finding it unconstitutional, right, and just treating it as a matter of judicial discretion, akin to what the remedy this court fashioned in Foster. The other way would require something more of a wholesale revision of the statute, requiring that the element be alleged in the indictment and being very...
Well, I thought you were suggesting if the state had alleged it in the indictment and then a jury also made a finding.
And I do believe that would make it constitutional, Your Honor. But
So there is... There would be a path to utilize this enhanced penalty.
Yes, Your Honor, there would be such a path.
Without changing the statute.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Without changing the statute, there would be a path to utilize it if the prosecution wanted to go down that road.
I think it would be in the nature of some ad hoc procedural development as opposed to really a redefinition or enactment of the statute to comply with what Elaine requires. I don't know.
So, counsel, let me just ask you, based on that, then the quality of the evidence would dictate the length and severity of the punishment, the sentence. Is that what you're saying would be okay?
I am saying that a jury determination with respect to this issue of corroboration is necessary for the mandatory sentencing aspect of this provision.
I understand that, but let's go further than that. Is the underlying information that the jury would have to find, that there's corroborating evidence, sufficient to enhance the sentence? Do we have any other examples of that where if there's an eyewitness, so to speak, you know, for example, then you're going to get a stiffer sentence. If there's, you know, a DNA, you're going to get a stiffer sentence than circumstantial evidence. That's what my question is here.
I'm not aware of anything in Ohio jurisprudence on that point.
What about the idea of putting this as a specification to the felony? If you were to say there's a specification to the gross sexual imposition that is corroborating evidence, and then specified that that would lead to the mandatory minimum.
I think that is exactly what it may take, Your Honor. I think there needs to be a separate jury determination as to the existence or non-existence of corroboration in order for this mandatory sentence to be imposed.
Mr. Strait, you're arguing two different sides of the same question. You're saying one is an additional element, but in response to the Chief's question, this is simply corroborating evidence that adds to the penalty. So if you have two witnesses, you get a greater penalty. If you have three witnesses, you get a greater penalty. But if you only have one witness and you're still guilty, you don't get the greater penalty. The question is whether or not the statute enhancing the penalty for corroborating evidence is constitutional or not. And you've answered the questions of our court differently. You've said to Justice Pfeiffer, well, it is constitutional. And then you've said, well, it isn't constitutional. So what I'm asking you is, what is your position on the statute?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize for any lack of clarity in my answer. I intended to be as consistent as I could be. My position is the issue of corroboration is an element. It's an element that has to be alleged. It's an element that has to be established by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It is a jury question. It is not a judge question. Now, in response to Mr. Justice Pfeiffer's question, are there ways of satisfying the constitutional issue? Yes, but it will probably take legislative correction of the statute in order to do that.
So you differ from what Judge Snyder said in his trial court opinion?
I don't know that I do, Your Honor, because
his
found the Apprendi violation
as well.
The court
does not believe there's any rational basis for the distinction between cases where there is corroborating evidence from those where there is no corroborating evidence. And you say that there is a rational basis for that because you just told us it's a jury question. So that's where my confusion is in your argument.
And I apologize again for the lack of clarity. Let me back up and give you my view of Judge Snyder's decision, and that is, one, he found a due process issue because of this lack of a reasonable basis for the distinction. And secondly, he went on to find the Apprendi violation of the Sixth Amendment, this belongs to the jury argument. So we have Judge Snyder saying two things, and I concur with both of those analysis. I think he's right in both respects. So yes, I think there is an issue with respect to the lack of a rational basis here. We don't see any reason why, as a matter of criminal process or criminal justice, the two different circumstances should be treated differently, when there's corroboration or when there's not. But that does not affect, nor does it answer, the overriding issue regarding the Sixth Amendment issue.
And you're saying that the Allain case is really specific as to that issue and is the most helpful to us in this particular case?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And I do that because, one, it's the most recent case, and two, because the analysis is a logical extension of what the court has said previously. Now, I need to make clear exactly how we see this as being changing the sentencing floor. It makes it non-probationable. Mr. Beverly had to go to prison. He will not be entitled, can't even apply for judicial release. He has to stay in prison. So that changes the sentencing context altogether. And in the view of the court in Allain, it changed the floor. The floor is different, and it's different because of this factual determination, the existence or non-existence of corroboration. Unless there are other questions from the court, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Strait. Mr. Taylor. Mr. Taylor, why don't you start by telling us why the quality of the evidence should enhance a sentence? Quality or quantity?
I think one of the things I wanted to emphasize is that I'm not a big proponent of corroboration requirements, and I think I side with the comments in the Economo case where there were members of the court that expressed concerns about the antiquated nature of those requirements. But I think they are rational in the sense that the amount of evidence, the existence of additional evidence, is universally considered by actors in the criminal justice system to be relevant to the case. Prosecutors consider it in deciding whether to indict, whether to prosecute the case, what kind of plea bargain to reach, and generally how hard to prosecute the case. And I think it's equally rational for the General Assembly to use that same type of criterion in deciding whether they're going to trigger a mandatory sentence. There's already a presumption of prison created by the statute, and that's easily constitutional. But what they wanted to do, and I think there might be some other factors the General Assembly was considering, including prison resources and those types of issues related, who are we going to devote these prison resources to? And what they decided to do, they rationally decided to choose to impose a mandatory sentence on the offenders about whom there is the most evidence of guilt.
And but the enhancements, Mr. Taylor, are generally factual questions resolved by a fact finder. And so an indictment might contain a specification that the offender did or did not use a firearm in the commission of the offense. And then there's an additional, what we refer to colloquially as a gun penalty. Or in a kidnapping case, that the victim was or was not released in a safe place unharmed. And those are factual kinds of questions that relate to the amount or the time of the amount of punishment or the duration of the sentence that a court can impose. Here, it goes to the quantity of evidence to prove guilt. So after guilt is established, then if it's corroborated, we get another penalty. So there's more evidence of guilt. And that's my quandary with this case.
Well, I think your questioning raises a couple issues, and in fact, exactly what you said is what distinguishes this criteria from the findings of fact that are subject to Apprendi and Alain. But as far as the rationality of using the amount of evidence or the volume of evidence, again, I think it's something that people in the criminal justice system consider all the time and rationally do so. The amount of evidence is relevant to how hard you prosecute the case.
Can you give me an example? We're not talking about prosecuting the case, because the case was prosecuted on four counts of a gross sexual imposition against this child, correct?
Four counts, yes, and he pled to two.
Right. So you plea bargained this case, correct?
Yes.
All right. Yet you had corroborating evidence. So when you say that the prosecution makes a determination on how hard to prosecute a case and which way to go with it, I understand that. But this wasn't about the prosecuting of the case. You had prosecuted it. You entered into what he was going to plea to. And this has to do with the judge's determination of sentencing. So it's not part of how the prosecution prosecutes the case.
Well, it's how hard the prosecutor thinks that the case should be prosecuted, and I guess that includes what sentence to seek. We made the defendant, we plea bargained the case to two counts of GSI carrying a mandatory sentence. That's a pretty strong plea bargain.
And he agreed to that.
And he agreed to that.
And the mandatory
except for
sentence,
the mandatory part, but
except for the mandatory part. That's a pretty big part not to agree to.
Well, he agreed he knew we were seeking the mandatory sentence.
Okay, but he didn't agree to
it. It was being legally disputed
sentence
at the time.
Okay.
But still, under the law that existed then, and it's a mandatory sentence because there's corroborating evidence, not just any corroborating evidence, the defendant's confession to reprehensible acts. So I think it's a pretty strong case, a pretty strong plea bargain, but that's no indicator that we somehow thought the evidence was weak.
No, I'm saying just the opposite. You had a dead bang winner here.
What was
the corroborating evidence? Mr. Taylor, the idea that you just pointed out the laws that existed then, I heard you say then, the Alain case was decided in 2013. And as opposing counsel has pointed out, we're talking about any factor that raises the minimum, the mandatory minimum here, would aggregate the punishment and would be a matter for the jury to decide. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that pretty clearly and has extended Apprendi. Would you say that this case is determinative here?
The Apprendi, first off, when this case was pending in the trial court, it was pretty clear under the case law that it did not the Apprendi line of cases did not apply to mandatory minimums, and so the trial court was incorrect in saying it did. After this case was decided in the Court of Appeals, again, mandatory minimums were not a problem at that point. They come out with the Alain decision. But it's not just any sentencing factor that triggers Apprendi. It's a fact that triggers Apprendi, the determination
Alain,
of a
though.
Fact.
Alain is the case that I'm concerned about.
Well, Apprendi leading up to Alain, you need a determination of fact. And I think Justice O'Donnell's question pointed out, this is not a determination of fact. This is about the quantity of evidence that's in front of the court. And
but your argument is it doesn't have to be found by a jury.
Correct. And I cite the Gabrion case, which is a Sixth Circuit case.
What is the corroborating evidence in this case that the state had?
The defendant's
offered?
Confession. He admitted to sexually molesting this girl.
Doesn't that go
repeatedly
to the fact? Doesn't that go to the facts of the case?
Well, as I argue in my brief, under the Economo case, the way the corroborating evidence provision or requirement works is that the judge makes a threshold determination. It's a question of law. Does there exist corroborating evidence in this case? The judge doesn't weigh the evidence or decide a fact of whether the additional evidence is believable or not. Just makes Economo makes this clear. It's a question of law.
So you had the testimony of the victim, obviously it was a plea, though, so there isn't a transcript, but you had a statement, presumably, or some investigation of the victim, and your view is, on behalf of the state, it was corroborated by the confession that you obtained from the accused. Is that it?
Well, this is one of the, basically, yes, but I think it's important to point out that the statute does not require corroboration of the victim's testimony. It requires corroboration of the violation. And so we not only had, obviously, the girl did report the abuse, and you should have the interview of the defendant where they talk about what the girl was saying. But the defendant then pled guilty, and then as part of the plea process
help
at the plea hearing.
Help me understand what this what the confession from the accused corroborated.
It corroborated the existence of sexual abuse. She had said that there were.
So there's an allegation from a victim, which is corroborated by an admission, and that's the corroborating evidence.
Correct, and it corroborated the indictment that he had committed sexual conduct against a child under 13. So
okay.
That's what's ultimately required. The victim doesn't have to testify under this provision, and the defense in other cases have made this
argument.
Counsel,
you say the victim doesn't have to testify, but when we're talking about enhancing a statute, enhancing a penalty, there has to be some evidence to be corroborated. And I guess I'm listening to your answer to Justice O'Donnell. What evidence was there in this case? Evidence, as we know from the rules of evidence.
Well, what's required to trigger the mandatory sentence?
I know what's required, counsel. My question is, what evidence was there in this case?
What's required is evidence other than the victim's testimony corroborating the violation that was admitted in the case,
and you will
corroborating
agree,
the violation.
You will agree there's no victim's testimony in this case?
He pled guilty, so there was no need to call the victim.
I'm trying to get to the point, counsel, when we're corroborating evidence, you will certainly have to agree in a plea there is no evidence.
We called the detective. We put the detective on the stand. We introduced his testimony about what the confession was, and we introduced a CD of recording of the defendant's confession. So that was the evidence that corroborated, that was admitted in the case. And it was admitted. It was formally admitted in the case that corroborated the violations.
But the fact of corroborating a violation, that's a factual determination, isn't it?
It's not a factual determination. The existence of corroboration under the Economo case is a legal threshold determination. It's a question of law, not a finding of fact. And that's what differentiates this from the findings of fact that are at issue in Apprendi, Elaine, and other cases, issues about how the offense was committed. What mental state the defendant had.
What's the test for determining whether evidence is corroborating?
Whether it corroborates the violation. And the test is, under the Economo case, it need not be independently sufficient to convict the accused. It need not go to every essential element. That language right there indicates that there's a distinction between this and what an element is.
Did the trial
slight
court
circumstances or evidence are enough?
Did the trial court make a finding there was corroborating evidence in this case?
What the trial court said at sentencing was that the corroborating evidence provision applied, but that he had found it unconstitutional. Now, in the in his written decision, the court took the position that maybe statutorily the provision did not apply because it was a plea-based conviction and those types of statutory arguments as to why it doesn't apply. I've argued that in my brief. I think all those arguments don't fly. It talks about evidence admitted in the case. It doesn't say admitted in the trial, so it doesn't have to be a disputed, it doesn't have to be a case that went to trial.
The question for us is whether or not the statute 290705 is or is not constitutional in this case. Is that right?
Correct. You have two constitutional issues that I think have been preserved, whether there's a rational basis to draw this distinction and whether it violates the Apprendi-Elaine line of cases. There's also a third issue raised in the defendant's reply brief.
And your point is it doesn't violate Apprendi because it's not a fact that
correct.
Needs to be found by a jury independently, as in Apprendi or in some of the other.
It's a question of law decided by the court. Does this evidence corroborate the violation? It's a threshold inquiry. It's not a factual determination.
And if the court makes that finding, it only makes the penalty mandatory. It doesn't increase the penalty. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, there's a ingoing presumption of prison for the offender. This merely
makes
the prison mandatory.
But that's a presumption that can be rebutted by a trial court, except if there's a corroborating evidence, in which case the court cannot have rebut that presumption, and it must impose a period of incarceration in prison.
Correct. It takes community control off the table and judicial release.
Thank you.
Counsel, if we were to accept the propositions of law, what, in your view, would be the practical impact in a plea case where there's a guilty plea? Could you ever, would it ever apply where there's a guilty plea?
If you accept the defendant's propositions of law?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you find it irrational, I think there'd be two consequences. Number one, we wouldn't be able to rely on it anymore at all. So we would just have the presumption of prison, which no one is challenging. But number two, the next case you'll have is a case where the prosecutor is up here saying it's irrational in the sexual imposition case statute to have a corroborating evidence requirement. It's no less rational or no more rational to have it in the sexual imposition statute in terms of the guilt phase than it would be in the penalty phase. So if you find it irrational, then the next case is going to be a prosecutor up here challenging the rationality of any corroborating evidence.
What if we find it rational, but we say, but it is a question of fact that would have to be determined by the jury? Does that mean you could never have it in a case? It would never apply where you have a guilty plea if you always have to have a factual finding by a jury?
I think what we would do then is include it in the indictment and have him plead to the additional element of the existence of corroborating evidence.
Thank you.
If a person accused of an offense is required to knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive rights with the understanding of what the maximum penalty can be, wouldn't a trial court have to advise that because of the corroborating evidence, it's mandatory period of incarceration in every case, or not?
Yes, and this defendant was aware that it was mandatory under the state. It was an unusual
presumption of prison. I'm talking about mandatory prison.
Yes, absolutely. You have to advise the defendant at the plea hearing.
And so we would have to go through the colloquy to determine that the defendant had been properly advised.
But isn't it the maximum penalty we're talking about? That doesn't change the requirement of the maximum penalty. This is not an Apprendi case. We're talking about raising the floor, not the ceiling.
Well, Criminal Rule 11 requires that you advise a defendant whether he's ineligible for community control. So if this mandatory sentencing provision applies, that would be one of the advisements or one of the bits of information you would make certain the defendant's aware of. If I could just conclude, I started to talk about a third claim that's being raised in the defendant's reply brief, and that is the defendant's raising a void for vagueness challenge, or at least there's a lot of briefing in there that sounds like he's raising a void for vagueness challenge. And I just wanted to point out that wasn't raised in either of the trial courts. I haven't had a chance to brief it, and I would ask that the court disregard it. If the court does want to go down that road and address that issue, I would ask for the opportunity to brief it.
Thank you.
So I would ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Strait, you've got 3 minutes and 44 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the starting point for my rebuttal would be to take issue with Mr. Taylor's reliance on State versus Economo for a couple of reasons, not the least of which being Economo predates Apprendi and Blakely and Booker and Elaine. At the time the court decided Economo, Sixth Amendment jurisprudence was radically different than it is now. And in fact, Economo wasn't a Sixth Amendment case at all. It had to do with a determination of how much evidence is sufficient to constitute corroboration under the sexual imposition statute. I question the ongoing validity of Economo in light of these changes in Sixth Amendment cases, as
but,
announced.
But it establishes the test for what qualifies as corroborating evidence, correct?
It does say that, Your Honor.
So that's still good.
Well, it's still good. We still have the issue of who gets to decide, though.
I understand that. But, the test, which is a pretty light test to qualify evidence as corroborating evidence in Economo, but that would, if we determine that it is a trier of fact responsibility here, that still could be, for example, jury instructions based on that.
Yes, Your Honor, there could be. But it would remain a jury question.
Correct.
So in that regard, I take exception with the state's comment that it was a question of law. I don't know that that can continue in light of Elaine and Blakely and Booker. I think it's a question for the jury, which really is the big issue that we're talking about here today. It seems pretty clear to us that, Elaine's directive is clear. Factors such as this are for the jury. They have to be charged in the indictment, they have to be submitted to the jury, and they have to be proven.
So if the General Assembly decides not to change the statute at all, this would never apply in a situation involving a plea, correct?
Well, in situations involving a plea, I suppose it's possible for the parties to agree to anything subject to court approval. So yes, I can see that it would be possible for a plea to end up with a sentence that is a mandatory sentence. But again, that would depend on the facts and circumstances of the case.
And that would be without the indictment containing this?
No, I think the indictment needs to contain it as well.
You still have to have
yes,
that.
I do.
Yes,
I do. I think, again, if it's an element such as Elaine says it is, mm-hmm. it has to be alleged. Otherwise, the defendant really has no notice at the outset of the proceedings exactly what he's going to be subject to.
But, counsel, the scenario you're putting forth where everybody in the room agrees to the mandatory sentence, wouldn't it, pursuant to the statute, still require evidence and corroborating evidence? I guess that's where I'm hung up, is that pesky word, evidence.
Well, yes, and it does pose some certain analytical problems for us. I think it is possible to structure the plea agreement so it's in the nature of a stipulation, which would constitute evidence. But I
think the stipulation evidence?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. I think a stipulation constitutes evidence. If it is a true stipulation agreed to the parties and accepted by the court.
And that stipulation would contain the underpinnings of the stipulation, which would be admitted into the record.
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. Okay.
Thank you.
We ask the court to reverse. Thanks.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen. Thank you very much.